Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once, or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box podcast from The Times with me, Matt Chorley, featuring the best of my Times radio show, which you can listen to Monday to Friday, 10 till 1. Today, I was joined by an absolute legend, actual David Dimbleby. One of the things I asked him about is how to get through an election night programme. I'm hosting the overnight programme for the US elections, 1 till 6 a.m., and he gave me advice on how to get through that. But we need your help. We know we've got thousands of listeners to this podcast in America. If you are in America and you want to come on the show, we want to find a listener in every US state. So email me matt.chorley@times.radio and we can get you on the election night program on November the 3rd. Anyway, quite enough of that. Let's talk to David Dimbleby. Now, forget the politicians, the former prime ministers and so on that we sometimes let onto the show. They come and go. But my next guest is frankly a permanent fixture of the Constitution. David Dimbleby has been the voice of 10 British general elections, countless local, European and US presidential elections, 25 years of Question Time, and of course a referendum or two.
The British people have spoken and the answer is we're out.
Well, not just politics, but moments of national joy and grief too. Remembrance Sunday, royal weddings, funerals and jubilees and whatever else. And now he's reinvented himself as an annoyingly good podcaster. And he joins me now. Good morning, David.
Morning, Matt.
Thank you so much for joining us on Times Radio. Is there nothing you can't turn your hand to?
Well, you describe my life in broadcasting in a very flattering way. But the truth is, I suppose I started broadcasting when I was 11, believe it or not.
Wow. Was this because of your dad? You were dragged into it young.
Yeah, I was. I tell you what I did. I did an edition of Family Favourites, which was a record request programme. And I remember it really well because it was on Boxing Day and I was driven up to London by my dad and somebody else had dropped out. That's the way of my life. People drop out and I take over. But anyway, I went and did it. And I remember the most cringing bit. One of the cards I had to read out was from somebody who was asking for my very good friend, The Milkman by Fats Waller, and said, I think I am blind. And I was an 11-year-old, and I had this card in front of me, and I just blurted out, I'm sorry you're blind, but I'm afraid there's nothing we can do about it. Because I think I thought, you know, the BBC, it can do anything.
But you can't do anything about that.
It's just lived with me, that awful remark all my life.
Do you think that's the worst thing that's ever happened to you on air?
No, the worst thing was drying up completely when I did my first big sort of, when Panorama was off the air, I did a thing called Outlook Europe. And I did a thing which is, oh goodness, it's so, yeah. I'd written a script for myself. We didn't have autocue in those days. And it was Macmillan I was talking about. And I said, the Prime Minister, and I'd written a line that went on the one hand and on the other. And it on the one hand, he could say and so, and on the other, and I can clean forgot what the other hand was, and I simply dried up. Normally mistakes in broadcasting are fine. I've had panoramas where everything goes down, it's fine. Elections are terrific. You know, things go wrong all the time, and you know the viewers on your side if things go wrong. You know, as long as you do your best, it's okay. But no, those are the two ones I remember best, I think, or worst, I suppose, a bit better way of putting it. But broadcasting, I just enjoy, you know, I don't know why, I just enjoy broadcasting and podcasting. This, the Fault Line we've been doing with Something Else Productions with Joe Sykes, the producer, has been absolutely fascinating. We did the Sun King Festival, which was about Rupert Murdoch, your stable.
Yes, and, of course, the boss.
That went
the boss.
Down. and I just like the it's a change of pace, because in podcasting you are much more sort of listening to people, seeking, you're not, it's not, you don't interview people on podcasts in the ones I've done. It's not an interview process. It's getting them to reflect on things that are 5, 10, in this case 17 years ago, and I find they're very forthcoming and interesting. And if you do a lot of it, you can piece together a picture, in this case, of what the run-up to the war in Iraq was like. And it's just a different way of talking. It's more, you know, you're talking into somebody's ear, really, and you have to change the whole pitch of your voice and the way you do it. And I don't know, I just find it fascinating. I mean, because I just enjoy talking now.
And why,
like you.
Exactly, Rob. You've got to, and you've got 3 hours to fill. You're just going to keep talking. Why did you choose the Iraq war then? It's called The Fault Line, Blair, Bush and Iraq, and it looks at how and why the invasion took place. Why did you pick that as a topic for a podcast series?
Because I think the crude version of what happened, Blair, the war criminal, and all that, was far too crude as a description of how we got in to the war in Iraq. And that what was really interesting was how there were a whole series of events between 9/11 and the actual invasion of Iraq that could have suggested that they were on the wrong track about weapons of mass destruction. But they were constantly ignored, both by the American administration and by Blair. And there's a strange connection between the two. I mean, George W. Bush, remember, America had a longstanding policy of regime change in Iraq. We didn't. Regime change in Iraq is illegal by British law. So but Tony Blair has this sort of slightly messianic view about the role of democracies in exporting democracy and changing dictatorships, which was reinforced by Kosovo and by Sierra Leone, which had been a success, and he'd been hailed as a hero. And I think he had this view that when the moment was right, you had to do your best to change the world for the better. He made a great speech in Chicago under Clinton, when Clinton was the president. He was already prime minister, of course. And I think he had a kind of idealism about it. And then 9/11 happens and he offers his support to George W. Bush. But the Bush administration is divided. There's part of it, people like Karl Rove and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, who actually believe that it's the duty of America to go in and get rid of Saddam, and to use 9/11 as the reason to do that, even though there's scant evidence that, indeed, no evidence. In this episode, we show that there was a sort of purported evidence that Saddam had been training al-Qaeda, but it was rubbish. He hadn't been. And that they should use the moment to unseat Saddam, and that would make the world a better place. And Bush and Blair kind of gets drawn into this argument, saying, we'll support you, but then is aware that he can't, even though he says, I'm with you, whatever, in one famous memorandum, that actually, from the point of view of Britain and the Labour Party, that's not enough. You can't just say we want to get rid of Saddam, and indeed it would be illegal, and therefore you have to have a proper reason. And the reason is Saddam's failure, and this is the linchpin, to get rid of his weapons of mass destruction. So what happens is, that Blair persuades Bush that you need a new resolution at the United Nations to allow inspectors in. And if Saddam has weapons of mass destruction and won't get rid of them, then there's a cause for war, and you can go in, and that will satisfy Bush's aim and the neocons' aim to get rid of the regime. But at the same time, it will satisfy the British Parliament and people that they're doing the right thing, because this man is famously, in 45 minutes, can attack London, which is what the headline in the Evening Standard said. And so they go for that. But what emerges all the time is actually, and it's coming through during this whole time, that nobody can find any weapons of mass destruction. And as we know, in the end, it emerged there were none. And Blair says in the podcast, when I asked him, what did you feel when you realized there were none? And he said, I felt very angry. Interesting word. He felt angry because he'd used that as the casus belli, and it had turned out to be phony, false. But the key thing is that all during this 18 months, information was being fed to the American administration and to our intelligence by sources who turn out to be, on the one hand, fake, who are making money out of saying that there's weapons of mass destruction, we know where they are and all that. And on the other hand, people coming and saying, look, we don't think he's got them. We think he got rid of his weapons after the first Gulf War in Kuwait, after he was thrown out of Kuwait and the inspectors went in, and we think he got rid of all his weapons. So we don't actually think he has any. And there's one particular key witness. It's a fascinating story. The Iraqi foreign minister, Chalabi, wanted to quit Iraq to flee because he wanted to become president, of course. And he had information that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And they had contacts with him, but they were ignored. The CIA said to the White House, we've got information that from this very high source that there are no weapons of mass destruction. And they took no notice because, like a steamroller, they were, you know, they were going on.
They focused on the information that they wanted.
But that's what?
They basically focused on the information they wanted that bolted their case, and they ignored and looked the other way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, they focused on the information they wanted, and certainly kind of, I don't know whether ignored is the right way to put it. I mean, in London terms, our intelligence agencies had a kind of fairly modulated view about weapons of mass destruction. You remember the famous argument about whether the dossier was sexed up or not. And Blair had written an introduction to it that was slightly more, well, considerably more positive about WMD than the reports coming in from intelligence. So they went back to the intelligence sources, you know, the head of John Scarlett, and said, you know, could you find a way of just slightly, you know, perhaps making this clearer or something? In other words, they were always looking for justification for a course that Blair by then was pretty well committed to. Yeah. I'm with you, whatever.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary story. And it's not the blunt story about Blair, the war criminal. It's about how when you set out on a political course and you decide it's the right thing to do, and in Blair's case, from a high moral standpoint in his own mind,
yeah,
you can get sucked into something and find it very, very difficult to withdraw. I mean, he could have withdrawn. And remember, Bush said, if this is too difficult for you, don't do it. Then Bush didn't need Britain. But Blair needed to be with America because that was his view, that, you know, there was a special relationship, that we were democracies, that we stood together. And, you know, if there was sufficient evidence and just about WMD, then we would stand with America come what may. And as a result, we sent 45,000 troops in.
You can get more of the latest political news with a subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times. Subscribe today and get 1 month free. Go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about? You insane Hollywood ass. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I want to talk to you about public trust, because lots of people, in particular, attribute, we heard the clip of you announcing the result of the Brexit referendum. They attribute that to a sort of collapse in public trust in institutions, which goes back through, you know, we had the financial crisis, we had the MPs' expenses scandal. Do you think that that erosion of trust began with Iraq?
I think it was a very big contributing factor. I think to have your prime minister go to war with a huge majority in the House of Commons who'd been persuaded that Saddam was an imminent threat, to go to war and then to discover that the reason for going to war just wasn't there,
yeah,
that there just were no weapons. I think that did, yes, was hugely, hugely damaging. Of course, as you say, there are other things. I mean, the expenses scandal was very damaging. We've been deceived by our politicians before. Anthony Eden deceived us over the invasion of the Suez Canal in 1956. You know, and said that it was an independent thing of the French and the British, and it turns out it was in collusion with Israel. You know, that there are always moments of deception, but I think it combines with a kind of, it's odd, it combines with a kind of feeling that the political system and politicians belong to us much more than I think people used to feel. I think there used to kind of be a feeling that the politicians were, on the whole, you know, you didn't quite understand why they did it or who they were, but they were sort of decent people who got on with it and you got on with your life, you know. And in moments of crisis, like the Second World War, you turn to them and Attlee comes in, you get the National Health Service, that's good. You know, on the whole, they're working in your favour. And I don't know whether it's because of the increasing sort of use of media, it probably has a part to play in it, and people having much more of a voice than they used to have. Indeed, you mentioned Question Time. You know, that was a place where week after week after week, people could go on and have their say. People felt that they deserved to be empowered more than just by a five-year general election, and therefore they could demand more of their politicians. And therefore, when their politicians failed to deliver, the expenses scandal being a very, very good example of it, that they just didn't, you know, the expenses scandal, they just didn't understand what these politicians were doing, who appeared to be lining their pockets,
and that
albeit
was
actually on a very small scale and with the connivance, apparently, of the expenses office in the House of Commons.
And that, was a pretty explosive moment, wasn't it, on Question Time, when in the days after the expenses scandal broke? I remember they sort of really stick in my mind as episodes of Question Time, which just sort of exploded. And do you think people became...
There was one particular one. I remember a particular one, Margaret Beckett. I think we were in Grimsby. And there were two women in the front row, very, very angry. And one of the things on her expenses claim had been flower baskets to decorate the front of her house in her constituency or something like that. I must be careful. I think that what it was. Anyway, and it was a small sum of money. And one of the women said, are you going to give it back, the money, that is? And she bridled and slightly blushed and said no, because in her view, what she'd done was perfectly right. And the audience just erupted with fury. I mean, it was just extraordinary. And those audiences are powerful, have a powerful effect, because they're a sort of test. That's why it's so sad at the moment we can't get the Question Time audiences together because of COVID. I mean, I remember when John Major was in his sort of in the worst part, just before he lost the election, and all our audiences were against Major and the government. And we'd have Conservative ministers on and they'd say, this is a, you know, the usual thing. Oh, this is biased. And then they'd listen to the audience. And afterwards, over supper, they'd say, you know, the terrifying thing is it's not biased, is it? the Tories have turned against us as well as Labour.
You just couldn't find anyone who would
be... that kind of impact.
And so that's the audiences and what you learned from the audiences. What about the panellists? Who do you think were the best and worst guests that you had on the Who was particularly good at doing it, first of all?
Well, the good ones are the brave ones who speak their mind. And I, from three parties, I would list Tony Benn as one. I'd list Shirley Williams as another, voices from the past. And Michael Heseltine, Kenneth Clark, always good. I mean, the politicians of stature, what I would call politicians who understand that one of the jobs of a politician is to engage with ideas and argue with people, they were the good ones. And the thing that was so depressing over in recent years, I think, was this feeling that politicians were being told by their press advisors to, quote, there's nothing in it for you going on Question Time, as though somehow the cosmetic was all that mattered, and forgetting that actually what matters is that the politicians are responsible to us and should come on, come what may, and argue the toss, because that's the job of a politician. You can't hide, you know. You can't just hide away, like all these things of, you know, Boris Johnson not appearing on the BBC during the last election, refusing to do interviews with Andrew Neil, all that stuff. I just think that's a kind of arrogance among politicians. I mean, I do understand why their advisors say there's nothing in it for you to be monstered by Andrew Neil. But actually, if you're a politician, you should be able to be and hold your corner being monstered by Andrew Neil. You know, he's not the devil incarnate. He's just a persistent interviewer. So, you know, I think that that cosmetic side of politics, this sort of pussyfooting around the issues, not going on unless you feel it's, you know, you've got something going for you, is damaging, actually, to our democracy.
I should point out, Andrew Neil's going to be on Times Radio in a couple of weeks, sitting in for John Peanut. So we ought to have that on the posters. He's not the devil incarnate. He's just a good interview.
he'd resent that.
Yeah, he'd.
What do you mean I'm not the devil incarnate?
People say, oh, this is the worst cabinet we've ever had. It's all low calibre. You know, there's no big beast left. Is that something that people have always said? Or do you think that this is particularly true of this particular cabinet?
I think it's more true of this particular cabinet. Yes, I think it's something that people have always said. People have always said ministers are useless, haven't they? I mean, unless they're on your side. So opposition has always said, you know, doesn't know his ass from his elbow, you know. I mean, I think that is kind of endemic, but I do think this one, I mean, you'd know better than me, Matt, because you're closer to it than I am now, but I think it is true. There are one or two people who stand out, obviously. Chancellor being the most obvious example, and there are one or two who clearly are not quite up to the job. But and of course there was an error made, wasn't there, at the beginning by Johnson of only choosing fervent Brexiteers, which limited the gene pool, and that damagingly, I think.
And who do you think is particularly hopeless?
Not going to say.
It was worth asking the question. Which actually, this is one of the things I wanted to ask, because you've done so many one-on-one interviews as well. What's the best interview question?
What?
Is there a particular question that is to ask a politician which either sort of wrong-foots them or gets them to open up? Or what's the best sort of question?
No, there's no particular question. I mean, there's a predictability about the answers you get. That's the first thing. And so you have to be fleet of foot to work out how to take the argument on. I mean, Robin Day, a great political interviewer, for my money, the best political interviewer and actually the founder of political interviewing, really. Robin Day used to say that he'd ask the Prime Minister, his opening question would be, what's your answer to my first question?
Because that's just what, and, they're going to say it regardless of what you ask.
Well, exactly. He'd get a predictable answer, whatever you got. But I think the thing is, I mean, everybody has a different style of political interviewing, you know, and mine with Margaret Thatcher, for instance, was to, how can I put this? People have, when I was doing political interviewing at number 10 for Panorama, once a year we do the Prime Minister, Walden was doing weekend show as well. Now, he was very kind of, he had a kind of great chart of where the questions should be, and it was very sort of analytical, and it did work quite well. Mine is much more to listen very carefully and then say, really? And why, you know, why do you think that? And I, and that, that works too. And then other people are aggressive, which I'm not by nature. And that works as well. I mean, but my take, I remember my best, I think my best moment in using that technique was with Margaret Thatcher just before an election, when she said, we were talking about society generally or something. And she said, I can't bear people who drool and drivel about caring. And I thought, what? And I just said, I didn't say, you know, that's an outrageous thing to say. She said, I said, drool and driveling. And there was a pause. She said, I'm sorry, Mr. Dimbleby, I shouldn't have said that. And then at the end of the interview, this was just on election eve, I said, have you learnt anything from your campaigning during this election? She said, I've learnt something from you today, Mr. Dimbleby. It's not enough just to say you care. You have to show you care. And I felt, oh, right, there
wow.
we go.
From the Iron Lady, that's quite the turnaround.
Well, it was. But, you know, she was a difficult, always a very difficult interviewee. I mean, she would throw, you know, all politicians, I think, kind of throw confetti in your face to put you off the trail. You know, you ask a question and they go off and answer something else, knowing that you've only got, one of the things is knowing you've only got limited time. I mean, the joy of the podcast, the joy of the fault line is that you, I mean, for instance, Tony Blair, who features right through it, but I talked to him in all for an hour and three quarters. Now, you would never get an hour and three quarters with Tony Blair on television or on radio. You get it because it's a conversation. He knows it's going to be edited. It's not done under lights, you know, with camera crew and sound crew and all that. So it's not like a performance quite the same way. And it's a lovely, slightly insidious way of kind of getting under the skin, the podcast. That's what I enjoy about it. So when you started by saying, do I like broadcasting? I do love it. And I love this new form of it. And I'm hope to go on doing it, really, because there's a lot of material out there. I mean, I'm interested in, for instance, the Good Friday Agreement might be one where you just go back and talk to people about what actually happened. When did you think it was going well? When was it going badly? All that. With time, people will talk about
it. I was going to say that you need that distance to be able to look back. You know, it's too soon to do so.
Yes, out of the fray. No longer in the fray. Still, of course, defending their point of view. Still explaining, but explaining in a more subtle way and explaining in a kind of modulated way why they reached the decisions they did. Not being asked to apologise, not being asked to say I did it wrong, but just to explain why they did it the way they did. And that's what the fault line is about.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you, because reading the papers over the weekend, there was lots of talks of MBEs and damehoods and knighthoods and so on. And knowing you were coming on, I thought, why is it not Sir David Dimbleby?
I'll tell you exactly why it's not. Regardless of whether I've been offered one or not, I've always said publicly, I don't think political journalists or broadcasters should take any honour that comes through Downing Street, because it's tainted. If it comes through Downing Street, it means the Prime Minister's approved it. And, you know, I just think people think, well, so maybe he was pulling his punches to get a knighthood. Huh?
Yeah.
No?
Yeah. Yeah. No,
I've always publicly said I would never take any honour of any kind. And as a result, of course, I've never been offered one.
Nobody's ever offered you one. That seems fair enough. I wanted to, a couple of weeks now, the US presidential election, I'm doing for the first time the overnight results show here on Times Radio.
Lucky you.
What advice have you got to basically stay awake, keep tabs on everything, to cram all of the swings and key states in my mind? What tips have you got for getting through election night?
Just spend from now till election night learning every single state and every, you know, all the key issues in every state, because in the end it comes down to that and people forget that. That's the thing. On the physical side, nothing at all. Adrenaline will keep you going, Matt. You don't worry about that.
Fantastic.
It's exciting. But the more you know about it, the more you've sort of boned up on it. That's obvious advice, isn't it? I know the other thing is, it's an odd thing to say, but remember that it's a big story. So don't get bogged down by the detail of Florida. You know,
there's a big you know picture what I mean? To focus
don't,
on. Yeah,
don't
yeah,
say,
yeah.
Oh, Iowa, that's really interesting. It is interesting, but actually the bigger story is who's going to be president, and you have to keep that in mind all the time. So it's a drama told through minutiae.
Well, I've made a good list there. I've written all that down.
Take no notice of it.
And I just need to finally ask you, because yes. My wife was very keen that I did. Are you going to do Strictly Come Dancing?
No, I don't think so. I've never been asked to.
You've never been offered a knighthood, and you've never been offered Strictly. Somebody needs to put these two things right.
I know. How can a man go to his grave without either of those things? Well, I will happily do so.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box podcast. You can now listen back to my whole show on the Times Radio app, where you can also now listen to all of the Times podcasts, including Red Box 2. Make sure you subscribe and review at the Red Box podcast wherever you listen. But for now, from me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.